history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some heroes around you. There are some seemingly ordinary Americans who have extraordinary stories to tell. And each week on this program, we have the chance to listen to them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And lately, we've been hearing from a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors as we count down to the 75th anniversary of that date, which has lived in infamy. And we're going to meet another Pearl Harbor survivor today. If you live in California's gold country, maybe you read about him in Friends and Neighbors magazine. Ski Bernacki, although I don't think your birth certificate says ski. What does it say on that birth certificate?
My real name is Chester. Middle name Joseph, but there's very few people that like to be called Chester because of the old days, the comic strip, for one example, and then, what do you call it, that Western, the guy with the limp.
Chester from Gunsmoke?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Well, and you know, speaking of comic strips, my middle name is Abner, so I can commiserate with you.
Hi, Abner.
So they started calling you Ski just because of your ethnic heritage?
Well, after I joined the Navy, most of the Polish names were difficult to announce. It was easier to say Ski than a big, long Polish name.
Uh-huh.
So it just hung on to me, Ski.
And you grew up in Massachusetts, the son of two parents who had immigrated from Poland.
Yes.
Polish was your first language?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My mother and father came over in the 1890s, I think. My mother came over in 1909, I think, and my father came over before that. My brother was born in 13, and I was born in 22. And my father participated in World War I.
Uh-huh.
He went over with the Polish-American Army, and he come back. He was kind of followed up with they used to call it, shell shock in them days?
Yeah.
War neurosis in my time, now
PTSD.
Yeah.
And I want to hear what you remember about your father and if he told you any stories about that. But I'm just curious as I think about you speaking Polish growing up. Now, when I say Ski Bernacki, am I saying that the way they'd say it in Poland?
Or would say absolutely not. No,
I didn't think so.
It used to be Trzesław Józef Biernacki.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
You just make it easier on us Anglophones.
So when I started school, they changed Trzesław to Chester.
Uh-huh.
And then Bernacki.
So you're growing up in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yes.
During the Great Depression.
Well, I was in that too, yeah.
What do you remember about those days?
Oh, I can remember going through the pea soup lines. Still to this day, you can't get a good bowl of pea soup like I used to have in them days. A loaf of bread and a bucket of pea soup, take home with you at noon. I used to go through the pea soup line and they'd ask you, how many are you in your family? And I'd raise my hand, like three or four, and that's how many scoops of pea soup you used to get back east.
You think it was really better soup, or you think it just tasted better because that's all you had?
Absolutely better.
Do you remember having some dreams, some ambitions as that young boy, what you thought you were going to do with your life?
The first thing I thought about was joining the Coast Guard, because they had a Coast Guard cutter in New Bedford station there. It was called, would you believe, the Tahoe?
Huh.
And one day I used to go crabbing up underneath the piers there in New Bedford, and I reached inside the porthole of the Tahoe and stole my first sailor hat.
How about that? How old do you think you were?
Oh, I had to be 10, 11, 12, something right in there.
Uh-huh. And who knew what a sailor hat would see on your head through 20 years in the Navy, not the Coast Guard? And you had ideas about getting into the Coast Guard, but they didn't want you?
What happened is it was four of us decided to go up there. We got inside of a 34-foot, and we went up to Charleston Navy out of Boston, and they examined all four of us, and a fella who we nicknamed the Colonel, because his last name was Mosakowski. And him and I were the only ones they would even consider taking, because we only had two teeth that had to be filled.
Uh-huh.
So they refused you until you get your teeth filled. So I went back, and then over time, and then all of a sudden I said, hell with that, I'm going to try the Navy. So I went up there, and I got my examination. I went home, and they called me. In the meantime, I got spiked playing baseball, sliding in the second base.
Uh-huh.
And when I got up there, I still had a little patch on my leg here, right here where I got spiked. And after I got examined, the doctor looked at me, said, what's that patch down there? And I told him, he says, go on back home until it's well and you're well enough to come back up here. I said, I can't come all the way up here. It's 52 miles from New Bedford to Boston. He said, well, why don't you go to Brockton, to the recruiting station there? So that's what I did. And I went up there, and then he said, go on home, we'll call you. So that's when I got called. I went back in. I went back up to Boston on August the 1st, 1940,
uh-huh.
is when I joined. Had my first bowl of beans, Navy beans, there in the post office building.
So you had to try three times to get into the service.
Well, yeah.
Why was that so important to you? Why did you want to do that so badly?
I don't know. I just wanted to get away from my brother mostly, because he used to beat the heck out of me, because he was more the, my mother would say, well, okay, you won't do what you're told, I'll tell your brother,
uh-huh.
you know.
And he was 9 years older than you, so.
Yeah. And when I was really young, he used to have to pull me around the wagon, and he didn't like that very much. You know, my mother said, take care of your brother. And he wanted to go with the gang, you know.
Sure. So you finally get into the Navy, August 1940. What did you think you were going to do?
I had no idea. I was just glad I got into service, and I was enjoying it. I really did. I went through boot training there, and after I completed my training, I went home on leave. And when I came back, waiting to be assigned, I lived aboard the Constellation, the sister ship to the Ironsides.
All right.
Awaiting orders and transfer to the West Coast. And I slept in there. Those overheads were so low you had to bend over. You slept in hammocks 10 days and lived out of a sea bag because you had no lockers and stuff. But I think I was in, I lived on the Constellation for about 3 weeks. And then they assembled a bunch of sailors and stuff and whatnot. And we got aboard a troop train and started out from the East Coast all the way to across. I remember one thing, Oklahoma, if I can tell you about this. Winoka, Oklahoma, we pulled in there, the train did, for taking on coal or water or whatever it was, and we were in the station there, and as we pulled out, there was a truck loaded with watermelons, and we lowered the windows in the passenger cars, and that truck drove alongside and was handing us watermelons through the window. And we proceeded on to San Pedro. Got to San Pedro, we got off the train, and we went down to the fleet landing and aboard more launches, and they took us out to the fleet. The cruisers and destroyers and battleships were all out there getting ready to go to Pearl Harbor. And when I got aboard ship to be assigned, years ago my brother told me, he says, if you're going to join the service, don't volunteer for nothing. And so they had us up on a forecastle, and they were asking different questions. Have you ever did this? You ever did that? You ever worked in a restaurant and stuff like that? And as you did, they pulled you out of the ranks and told you you were assigned to this division, you're assigned to this division. And the guys that were left over were put in a deck force, so that's how I ended up in a deck force. Anyway, we got underway and went to Pearl. And
this was on the Helena?
Yeah, on the boat.
Got
the
on it at San Pedro.
Yeah.
Tell us about that ship. This is a pretty big ship.
Oh, yeah. It was 608 feet long and so many feet wide. It had four screws, two engine rooms, two fire rooms.
Was that kind of exciting to be on a ship like that?
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed being in the service. I really did, honestly.
Did you have any inkling that war was coming?
Oh, no, not at the beginning. Everything was fine and dandy. You used to go down to Fort DeRussy, play handball, go to Nanakuli Beach, and the auditorium out there by Diamond Head, swimming in that big Olympic-sized, bigger than, I guess, a Olympic-sized swimming pool.
You swam in there, in that auditorium?
Yeah, a lot of times. I'd go on the beach, and being a seaman, you always had to get back by 12 o'clock. They used to call it Cinderella Liberties. And you couldn't stay on the beach overnight, you know.
Yeah, that's one of those pieces of history that's still there. They still have that natatorium there along the coastline, and you can tell that it's pretty old.
Yeah, Kaneohe, and I remember the old Polly.
So this was quite a life for the kid from Massachusetts out here in paradise.
I was living it up. Yeah, go down to Waikiki Beach and walk around.
And what kinds of things were you doing there at Pearl Harbor before the attack? in the weeks and months leading
up
to that?
Oh, well, what I remember about it, we did a lot of training. I was assigned a 5-inch 38 battery.
Yeah.
And I was a shellman. And so we practiced, it's semi-fixed ammunition. I was a shellman, and the shells weighed 60 pounds each. And there was a powderman and a trainer, pointer, and a captain. And we had a lot of training every day.
As a shellman on this 5-inch 38 gun mount, which is a huge gun, where you've got multi-levels of people that are working on it.
These 5-inch 38s on Helena and the St. Louis were mounts. On the Nashville and some of the other cruisers were open mounts, and they were 5-inch 25s, if I remember right.
Explain to us what that means as a shellman. What did you have to do?
Well, what I did is I waited for the powderman to put the casing in the gun, and then I took the projectile out of the fuse box, the hoist,
uh-huh,
which came up from the upper handling room.
So you've got guys a level below you who are sending these shells up.
Yeah.
You grab it
and
put it in.
Yeah.
And then they fire it.
Yeah.
What does that sound like?
Well, you didn't hear too much inside the mount. Most of the noise was outside.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know what it would be like with the open mount, you know.
So you guys practiced this quite a bit.
At least 3 or 4 times a week.
You know, there's a particular Sunday morning that I'm interested in hearing about, December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day?
If I can start out this way, the night before, I went ashore with a couple of buddies of mine. We got back at 12 o'clock. I told you about that Cinderella Liberty. And this one buddy, real good buddy of mine, Charlie Cioffi, had the duty that day, so he was on the quarter deck. Had the duty from 8 to 12. And I woke up in the morning, I did my thing, and then I had breakfast, and I decided I'd go ashore. So I went down to the Foot Locker, and I broke out my shoes and put another buffing on them, and I was sitting there, and I got an uncomfortable feeling. And I said, I think I'll go topside and have a smoke. So as I started up the ladder, the general quarters alarm sounded, and it says, all hands man your battle stations. Not knowing what the heck was going on, I dropped everything, which you were trained to do, and I headed for my mount, my battle station. And just as I got inside the mount, there was a big explosion. And I figured, what the hell's going on here, you know? We manned the mount, and they reported to sky aft, went into director control, and we started firing. From what I understand, I think we were the first ship to get hit. It came over Ford Island toward the 1010 dock that we were tied up at, in place of the Pennsylvania, which should have been there, but the Pennsylvania had moved forward into the dry dock.
Right.
Which was ahead of us.
And when you say there was an explosion, I want to make it clear for people listening, you're not talking about an explosion on another ship. You're talking about an explosion on your ship that you felt.
Oh, yeah, the ship just shook, and I didn't know what was happening. You know, who would think you were going to be in the start of a war?
Right.
You know, but like I say, being that we had so much training that everything fell into place, you did things automatically without even thinking.
And I want to ask about something else you said there, too. You know, you said that you were going to go ashore, and then you got an uneasy feeling. Premonition that something was wrong, or what?
I don't know what it was. I really don't. Honestly, I'm being honest. I think I'll just go up topside and have a cigarette, you know. And as I did, the announcing system from the quarterdeck are telling us, man your battle stations. So being trained like we were, everybody headed for what they were supposed to do. And what was bad about it is it happened so fast that we didn't have time to set the damage control all over the ship. So when we got hit, we got hit in the forward fire room, between the forward fire room and the forward engine room. Just put a big gaping hole in the side, and she just settled there at the dock, which wasn't very deep, you know, just deep enough to in and out.
Right. So if you guys would have been hit in the same spot on the ship but been in deeper water, it would have been a much different scenario.
Well, that's another story about Coolah Gulf.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. The end of your ship,
which
is no longer with us, at least not on the surface anywhere. So December 7th, this morning, you get to that battle station, and you're loading these shells, loading shell after shell after shell, I would imagine. But you can't see anything, right?
No, because we're inside the mount.
So you have no idea what's happening out there.
I had no idea. And then all of a sudden there was I forget how long we were firing, but then we had a lull. And we were told to go outside, clear the casings off the deck, throw them over on the dock, and cut the awnings down, because we had awnings, frilled awnings, you know, up over the bow and the quarter deck. And stuff. We had to get that canvas off the ship so it wouldn't catch fire and stuff and whatnot.
It's time to take our first break, but we'll go back to December 7th, 1941, when we come back with a man who was there, 94-year-old Ski Bernacki of Jamestown, California. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.